Ibrahim is joining us now from Deir al-Balah in central Gaza to bring us up to speed on all the latest developments on the ground from the Gaza Strip. Qaira, what do you have to share with us specifically as the assault on Gaza City continues to unfold now?
Falling victim to the Israeli brutal attacks and to the airstrikes the Israeli occupation army is waging and directing towards the civilian areas and the most populated areas in the Gaza Strip. And the focus of these attacks is surely Gaza City itself, which actually includes hundreds of thousands of people who had fled or escaped death in the north and in the east of the city towards the west. Nowadays, the west is actually jamming up with families who are displaced, who fled from the north and from the east of the city towards the coastal line, who are actually in very catastrophic situations and conditions as a result of the displacement, as a result of the continuation of the Israeli attacks. And today, they are living and experiencing unimaginable and indescribable situation as the Israeli occupation army launched its ground operation or ground offensive against them yesterday in the north of Gaza City. The Israeli tanks actually expanded and actually invaded many areas in the north of Gaza City, and actually now we are seeing and witnessing they are progressing from the north of the Sheikh Ridwan neighborhoods towards the heart of the city. And as they are progressing, more massacres are committed against the population, against the people here. More massacres and more airstrikes are targeting the most populated areas in the north of Gaza City. And the last massacre was in a Sheikh Ridwan neighborhood that resulted in the killing of seven people of the same family, Mas'ud family, after targeting the residential building. Another massacre targeted a group of civilians and a group of people who were fleeing from Tell el-Hawa neighborhoods. They were actually in a vehicle. The Israeli warplanes targeted the vehicle that was actually full of displaced people, for families and children, of course. So that was a very horrible massacre. Also, we are talking about the south of the city, the south of the Gaza Strip, which is actually not spared from the Israeli brutal attacks and from the Israeli artillery shelling. The more attacks are being carried out against the people in the south of the Strip. More massacres against the people are committed every passing hour. We are talking about at least 29 people killed from the dawn of this morning until now, and the number is increasing. The Israeli occupation army is not only attacking the people in north of the Strip, in Gaza City itself, but also in the south of the Gaza Strip, in the allegedly safe areas of Al-Nusayrat refugee camp, and also the south of Rafah and the west of Rafah, where the aid distribution centers are located. This morning, or in the past hour, a massacre was committed against the aid seekers in the west of Rafah itself that resulted in the killing of five at least and the injuries of more than 60 people. Among them, 20 are in critical conditions. The number is increasing as the Israeli occupation army keeps shooting and directly shooting towards the aid seekers in this area. This actually refutes the idea that more areas in the south of Gaza or in the middle area are safe zones or humanitarian zones. With one third of the casualties since the morning of this day until now were actually killed in the southern areas of the Gaza Strip. More people are still actually forced to go to these notorious aid distribution centers to go to seek aid or to collect whatever they can to feed themselves or to feed their families. And that highlights how the situation in Gaza is really very catastrophic from the humanitarian side. People are still in very dire need for the food and very dire need for the aid. However, they don't receive any aid as the Israeli occupation army keeps blocking the crossings and keeps disallowing the entry of aid to the humanitarian agencies and to the warehouses of the UNRWA. For example, for more than 6 months now, nothing has been allowed to enter the warehouses of the UNRWA, and the people are now living very catastrophic situations that are deteriorating every passing hour as the Israeli occupation army is deepening this humanitarian crisis by launching this ground invasion and by continuing the air strikes and the military operations against the people here in the Gaza Strip.
All right, thanks a lot, Qaira Ibrahim, joining us from Deir al-Balah in central Gaza. Well, amid the mounting global rebuke against Israel, Canada has slammed as horrific the ground offensive in Gaza City. Canada's Ministry of Foreign Affairs said The offensive worsens the humanitarian crisis and puts in danger the release of Israeli captives held in Gaza. Ottawa also said Israel must comply with international law. Foreign Minister Anita Anand issued a separate message in support of Gaza. She said Canada, along with its international partners, demand a ceasefire in Gaza, as well as an immediate and permanent flow of humanitarian aid to the Palestinian territory. Ottawa earlier said it will vote in favor of the Palestinian statehood at a Security Council meeting on September 20th. In the U.S., a coalition of labor unions, faculties, and students in the University of California have sued Donald Trump's administration over its freezing of federal funds. The case, filed on Tuesday, challenges what the plaintiffs call a pattern of unlawful financial threats against higher education. Those who submitted the case say that Trump's freezing of federal funds is aimed at curbing academic freedom. The lawsuit comes weeks after the Trump administration fined the University of California $1.2 billion and froze research funding. The U.S. government has launched probes into universities over student protests and campuses against the genocide in Gaza and has frozen funds because of the protests and other issues. It has also sought massive payments from universities to settle the probes. Iran says the implementation of the snapback mechanism of the JCPOA will render the country's recent agreement with the IAEA null and void.
At the gathering of countries in Qatari capital of Doha, it was demonstrated that the threat posed by the Israeli regime is a shared and serious concern among all regional and Islamic nations.
Bahrain warned that if the other parties fail to fulfill their commitments or seek to blackmail Iran, Tehran will take necessary countermeasures. The spokesperson also announced that Iran's foreign minister will have a phone call later today with his counterparts from the European Troika and the EU foreign policy chief. Bahrain further stated that each passing day, regional countries are increasingly concluding that Israel is the real, serious, and urgent threat to the stability and security in the West Asia region.
Tehran's problem with the agency has been that it issued reports under the pressure and influence of the United States and the three European countries at various times. The agency had taken positions beyond its technical mandate.
Bahrain stressed that the threat posed by the Israeli regime goes beyond the region. He said Israel is the only regime that has occupied the territory of two neighboring countries while committing genocide in Gaza. Bahrain noted that there is no principle or objective of the UN Charter or international law that has not been violated by Israel. Moving on, the second conference of Iran and the Economic Cooperation Organization is kicked off in Tehran. It brings together senior officials and regional representatives for discussions to shape the future direction of the bloc. The discussions come as the organization approaches the end of its 2025 roadmap, setting the stage for a new 10-year vision plan. Yusumi Shahmari has more.
In Tehran, regional cooperation takes center stage. The second National Iran Echo Conference has opened at the Foreign Ministry's Institute for Political and International Studies, with foreign ministers, policymakers, and academics in attendance.
The organization has tremendous potential. Moving toward multilateralism is one of our key objectives. That's why Iran decided to host this meeting, to take the initiative at a crucial moment as we prepare the next 10-year plan, known as Vision 2035.
ECHO traces its roots back to 1964, when Iran, Turkey, and Pakistan created the Regional Cooperation for Development. Today, the organization spans 10 countries, covering more than 8 million square kilometers and serving over half a billion people. Yet, experts say its full potential remains untapped.
Connectivity, trade integration, agriculture, food security promotion, and most importantly, relying on technology and artificial intelligence and digitalization. Now, these are new areas, but what we also want to hear from and what we also want to include in our processes is the active participation of the youth and the women.
This year marks the final phase of the ECHO 2025 roadmap. The new 10-year vision will be adopted at the upcoming Council of Foreign Ministers meeting in Kazakhstan this this November.
As we plan Vision 2035, our goal is to ensure it drives the economic growth of member states. At the same time, we must integrate new technologies and develop strategies to adapt to the changes they bring.
Iran has outlined future priorities, from trade liberalization and transit facilitation to digital transformation and artificial intelligence. As host nation and founding member, Iran sees ECHO as a tool to strengthen multilateral diplomacy and neighborhood policy. As the second Iran ECHO National Conference underscores lessons learned, Iran leads the way in planning Vision 2035, highlighting new strategies for the next decade. Yusuf Shahmadi, Tehran.
United Nations human rights experts have sharply criticized the U.S. for military strikes on Venezuelan boats. They describe the attacks as extrajudicial executions. Three independent UN special rapporteurs stated that under international law, all countries must respect the right to life, even when operating on the high seas or in foreign territory. They added that the use of potentially legal force is only permitted in personal self-defense or defense of others against an imminent threat to life. In recent weeks, the U.S. military has struck a number of boats allegedly involved in drug trafficking originating from Venezuela. The attacks resulted in the death of at least 14 individuals. Meanwhile, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has called for national unity, framing the strikes as a looming threat of war in the Caribbean against his country.
The United States government, in violation of all international laws, treaties, international agreements, and the United Nations Charter, has subjected our country to a multifaceted war, and particularly in the last 5 weeks, to an absolutely reprehensible, criminal, and immoral threat. The matter at hand is a threat of war in the Caribbean against Venezuela. And the way for us to contain the threat, neutralize it, and defeat it completely so that peace may prevail is through the unity of all sectors of Venezuela, above political, ideological, color, culture, race, and religious differences. National unity, national unity, national unity.
Maduro's remarks came as he earlier called on his own party to be prepared to take up arms if the U.S. attacks the country. Tensions have been on the rise between Caracas and Washington after the U.S. significantly expanded its military presence near the South American nation. U.S. officials have cited their fight against drug trafficking as an excuse for the deployment. Sudan has voiced full solidarity with Qatar following Israel's attack on the Qatari capital last week, calling the strikes a blatant violation of international law. From Khartoum, Abdullah Hussein reports.
Sudan has condemned the latest Israeli attack on the Qatari capital, Doha, calling it a blatant act of aggression. At the Arab Islamic Emergency Summit hosted by Doha on Monday, Sudan Sovereignty Council Chairman General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan described the strikes as a violation of international law and a direct threat to regional security. Sudan declared full solidarity with Qatar, its leadership, government, and people, urging decisive Arab Islamic and international action to confront Israeli aggression.
Qatar has always stood firmly with Sudan and liberation movements across the Arab and Islamic world, especially Palestine. Al-Burhan's visit shows Sudan's clear support for Qatar against aggression. These attacks proved one thing: America is no ally, and Qatar is not standing alone.
Back in Khartoum, the mood reflects widespread support for Qatar, denouncing Israel's repeated attacks on civilians and critical infrastructure. The public rejects these acts of aggression and occupation, calling for accountability, justice, and a halt to violence.
We welcome Al-Burhan's visit to Qatar and strongly condemn the Israeli aggression against our brotherly state. We call on all Arab and regional nations to stand in solidarity with Qatar.
The Sudanese people affirm their full support for Qatar. We denounce Israel's aggression and extend appreciation to Al-Burhan and the government for responding to Qatar's invitation.
The Doha Emergency Summit concluded with a united front from Arab and Islamic states condemning Israeli aggression, which they said threatens global security. They also called for an end to the impunity Israel enjoys, emphasized the importance of upholding international law and supporting Palestinian rights. Israel struck a Doha residence last Tuesday, where Palestinian negotiators were discussing a peace proposal for Gaza.
From Khartoum to Doha, Sudan's people and leaders unite with Qatar against the Israeli aggression. Their call is urgent: peace, protection, and justice for all civilians. Abdullah Hussein, Khartoum.
That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
You can talk it down, turn the other way. Fear the truth, but it won't go away. Can you hear it calling? Yeah. You can write it down, but nobody cares. It's an untold story of our biggest fears. It can reach you with no warning. There's a part of me that won't understand, having sleepless nights with my head in my hands. I'm here and tears are falling, yeah. If I could right the wrongs, would you lend me a hand? I would make a difference to this beautiful land. If I'm nothing, I have my intention. When the sun goes down and there's nothing left around, can you feel it? Can you feel it? When your knees are on the ground, you may fear, but it's allowed. Are you listening? 'Cause I need forgiving.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubah Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
After a three-year hiatus, the wheels of economic diplomacy are turning again between Iran and Pakistan. High-ranking delegations from both countries gathered in Tehran for the 22nd Joint Economic Commission, a two-day summit focused on deepening bilateral ties. Talks are co-chaired by Iran's Minister of Roads and Urban Development and Pakistan's Minister of Commerce and Trade. The Commission is addressing areas ranging from trade and investment to transportation, energy, and even environmental issues.
We can say we have a common ground for joint activities in regard to facing the challenges, upcoming challenges, existing challenges of climate change, And also we can exchange experiences on what the two nations have done for managing their protected areas, their wildlife. And happily, we have a document that is going to be signed during this joint commission. And definitely, it will be a step toward expanding our collaboration.
Discussions also cover the establishment of free trade zones and cross-border markets aimed at facilitating smoother transactions and boosting economic activity in border regions. Both sides see these initiatives as essential for regional stability and growth.
Iran and Pakistan's trade currently exceeds $3 billion, with Iran exporting $2.4 billion worth of goods to Pakistan in 2024. Both countries now aim to raise bilateral trade to $10 billion. Achieving this target will require adjustments in banking systems, easing trade regulations, and developing roads and infrastructure on both sides. Authorities from Tehran and Islamabad will work together to draw a roadmap to reach this goal.
This commission marks a turning point for Iran-Pakistan relations, with both sides seeking to overcome past challenges and create lasting economic partnerships. As Tehran and Islamabad revive their joint economic dialogue, both sides are now aiming for a roadmap to boost bilateral trade to the $10 billion horizon. Yusuf Shahmadi, Tehran.
The main topic on the agenda of this year's conference is the June attacks on Iranian nuclear facilities and ongoing threats by the U.S. and Israel to nuclear security in West Asia.
International peace and security are indeed at risk. And we have seen this throughout history in particular, but not only in the Middle East and dramatically last June in Iran when its nuclear facilities were attacked. Together with His Excellency Dr. Araghchi, we signed an agreement summarizing the technical measures, the practical steps that we need to do to resume this indispensable work.
The General Conference started with the election of Iran as one of the eight vice presidents with the support of the Middle East and South Asia group.
I would like to thank the majority of the members of the IAEA in this conference trusted Iran to be as one of the vice presidents of the conference, and especially I would like to thank our group, Meza Group, which entrusted Iran as a candidate.
Iran tabled a motion prohibiting any attack on nuclear facilities on Monday evening. The resolution is co-sponsored by Russia and China and will be debated on Thursday afternoon.
We ask countries to participate and vote to this resolution, because if they don't support our suggestion, it means that they are supporting jungle law in the force. So it is better to condemn U.S. and Israel and prevent further action as happened for us.
The Iranian resolution on the prohibition of attacks on nuclear facilities is based on common principles of the IAEA, such as the previous IAEA resolutions 533, 444, and the UN Security Council resolution 487.
Iran has put forward a draft resolution aimed at serving the international community. This draft resolution is firmly grounded in the perception of the mandate of the IAEA in full compliance with the statute and in adherence to the fundamental principles of international law and the Charter of the United Nations.
Islami also held bilateral meetings with the delegations of Russia, Venezuela and China.
This hall is divided between those who condemn attacks and threats on nuclear facilities and those who are joining the US, Israel and the E3 in their attempts to undermine the IAEA statute. But it's expected that most countries will support the Iranian resolution on Thursday. Dieter Reinisch from UN headquarters in Vienna.
For decades, the so-called two-state solution to the Israel-Palestine question has dominated Western diplomacy, enshrined in the controversial Oslo Accords of the early 1990s. 30 years on, many here say that solution was dead on arrival.
It's impossible now, in any event, even if it was desirable, which I don't think it ever was, to actually create a two-state proposition, because the West Bank, for example, has been completely atomized by the Zionist entity. So I think we need to rip that idea up and to start again. And what we're campaigning for is a one-state solution.
Critics of the two-state solution, now pushed for by Saudi Arabia and France at the United Nations, also pointed to Israel's ongoing genocidal assault on Gaza.
What they are actually doing is consolidating the gains made by the Zionist entity, which includes the absolute annihilation of Gaza, the continued terrorism that is being taken place by Israeli settlers in the West Bank. And what they actually want to do is consolidate the 80-odd years of Zionist settler colonialism.
The debate, organized by activist independent movement, grew heated, with some arguing for a state, including all Palestinians and those who live in what's now called Israel, if they wish to stay.
Every Palestinian should have the right to return. And Israelis who decide they want to stay will have obligation to assist the Palestinian to settle back to their home, and that means everywhere.
Opponents of that view argue it resembles South Africa after the end of apartheid, when many of the immigrant white population got to stay.
The concept of, you know, what is mine and what is yours is so simple, and actually people are trying to pretend there's shades of grey. No, actually it's very black and white. There's Palestine, and there's a fake terrorist construct called Israel that needs to be dismantled.
Dr. Ali also suggests that armed struggle by Palestinians is the only pathway to one state being materialized.
Armed struggle is legal under international law, and rather than, you know, and what we should be doing is arguing for deprescription of perfectly legitimate legal organizations under international law, we should be never condemning resistance.
At the end of the debate, it was obvious which motion received more support.
With the Israeli regime openly rejecting Palestinian statehood as it commits genocide in Gaza, the debate here mirrors a wider global reckoning. The two-state solution has repeatedly failed. The consensus here, a one-state solution with equal rights for all the indigenous inhabitants of historical Palestine. Saeed Pourreza from Birmingham, United Kingdom.
This Friday, the quartet comprising the U.S., Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Egypt issued a joint statement declaring that Sudan's war has created the world's worst humanitarian crisis and threatens regional peace and security. The group called for a three-month humanitarian truce, unrestricted aid access, and a clear transition process towards civilian-led governance within 9 months. By Saturday, Sudan's government delivered its response. While stressing it welcomes genuine efforts to ease the conflict, the government underlined that no initiative will succeed unless it respects Sudan's sovereignty and the legitimacy of its national institutions. The statement also rejected attempts to place the state on equal footing with the militia, emphasizing that Sudan alone has the right to shape its political path during the transitional period.
The Quartet's statement have no legal or international legitimacy. They were formed to impose guardianship on Sudan. The UAE fueled and funded this war. Everyone knows who arms the RSF. These resolutions are worthless, equating the army with the militia, and each time the army advances, the Quartet rushes to rescue the UAE's spoiled child.
Khartoum also noted that international actors have struggled to enforce previous UN Security Council resolutions, including those on the siege of Al-Fashir. While the Quartet is pushing for a new roadmap, analysts point out that earlier efforts failed to deliver lasting results, leaving questions about whether this latest initiative will move beyond the statement of intent.
From Khartoum, it's clear the government is drawing a firm line, welcoming any support to end the war, but rejecting what it sees as outside interference that undermines Sudan's sovereignty. Abdullah Hussein, Khartoum.
Britain's far right on the march again in their biggest show of strength yet, led by a man who made his name scapegoating migrants and Muslims and spreading conspiracy theories. Simultaneously, a counter-demonstration organized by rights groups and unions against what they call racism and the rise of fascism.
everyone should have free speech, but there's a defined line between free speech and hate speech, and some of the things he says is hate speech. So we have the freedom of speech to speak up and speak out about what's right and what's wrong.
I think it's a very cheap shot to point your finger at asylum seekers, people who are fleeing war-torn countries, wars that are created by the West. And, you know, I think it's we've got to show people like Tommy Robinson, who I hear is funded by Israel. You know, we have to show him what's what.
At the heart of the far right's rhetoric, immigration. They blame immigrants, especially non-Europeans, as the reason behind their economic woes. The counter-demonstrators here say the reasons should be sought elsewhere.
It's just a smokescreen. People need to wake up and realize that these people, these refugees who have come to seek solace in our country, are not the problem. They are not the problem. Look closer to home. Your government is your problem.
But that goes back to many, many years of austerity measures by the Tory government. I'm not hiding the fact that there's a lot of problems in this country in terms of like the economy, everything's been crashed, but it's not the refugees and the migrants that are to blame, but actually the politicians and their hypocrisy and their lies and their mismanagement of this country.
For 14 years, conservative governments imposed economic austerity while whipping up anti-migrant hysteria to distract from the damage. Under Labour, the promised change is yet to come.
They're angry with, and I understand some of the reasons they're angry, but I think they're blaming the wrong people. And yes, you have the right to free speech, but I think it should be based in fact. And a lot of their free speech that they claim isn't factual, and it's done to whip up anger, more anger for their own means.
Also tapping into that anger, right-wing Reform UK, led by wealthy politician Nigel Farage, whose party is rising sharply in the polls, with tackling migration top of his agenda if elected in the next general election.
At the heart of the problem, the demonstrators here say inequality, the failure of successive governments to look after the vulnerable, and the political system that fuels division rather than solving problems. Saipur is up, London.
On Monday, September 9, Ethiopia officially inaugurated the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, Africa's largest hydropower project on the Blue Nile. Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed hailed the moment as a historic achievement for his country and the wider region. But as Addis Ababa celebrated, the spotlight quickly shifted downstream to Sudan, where questions about water security and the dam's impact on daily life remain unresolved.
The GERD is a strategic project for Ethiopia to meet its electricity needs. Egypt and Sudan fear possible risks, but in my visits, I have seen that for Sudan, the benefits outweigh the harm. It curbs floods, provides electricity, and engineers have assured its safety.
For Sudan, GERD offers both potential benefits and risks. Experts say it could help regulate destructive floods and provide more stable flows for irrigation and power. Yet Khartoum fears sudden releases, shortages during dry seasons, and the broader issue of dam safety. Located directly below the massive structure, Sudan is most exposed to any mismanagement, making daily coordination and transparency essential.
The matter doesn't end with this inauguration. Sudan and Egypt must take a strong stance to protect their rights through all legitimate means. As observers, we should put forward realistic, workable solutions. In my view, the only practical path is genuine joint management of the dam, where every decision is made collectively by all three countries.
Just hours after the inauguration, Egypt addressed the UN Security Council, emphasizing that it will not recognize Ethiopia's unilateral control over Nile waters and reaffirming the importance of international law. Previous trilateral talks among Ethiopia, Sudan, and Egypt failed to produce a binding agreement, leaving the dispute unresolved. Sudan, for its part, has reiterated its rejection of unilateral measures in the Nile Basin and remains committed to pursuing diplomatic channels to safeguard its national interests.
Standing here by the Nile, Sudan's lifeline, the concerns are clear. Beyond the promises of electricity and flood control, the real question is whether Ethiopia's dam will bring cooperation or deepen the uncertainty downstream. Abdullah Hussein, Khartoum.
level Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you, and in this edition of the program, we'll have a look at the contents of Surah Al-Ankabut, or Chapter Spider, the 29th chapter of the Holy Quran. So, dear listeners, as you have been with us previously, we have reached the 10th verse of Surah Ankabut. So, before we start our discussion regarding this verse, let's listen to the verse under discussion.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
ومن الناس من يقول آمنا بالله فإذا في الله جعل فتنة الناس كعذاب الله فإذا أوذي في الله جعل فتنة الناس كعذاب الله ولئن جاء نصر من ربك ليقولن إنا كنا معكم أوليس الله بأعلم بما في صدور العالمين
And of the people are some who say, We believe in Allah. But when one of them is harmed for the cause of Allah, they consider the trial of the people as if it were the punishment of Allah. But if victory comes from your Lord, they say, Indeed, we were with you. Is not Allah most knowing of what is within the breasts of all creatures?
So, in view of the fact that there were mentioned some explicit statements about the righteous believers in two or three of the previous verses, and also the statements about polytheism and polytheists were mentioned in the former verses, in this verse, the words are about a third group, which is hypocrites. So the verse says, وَمِنَ النَّاسِ مَنْ يَقُولُ أَمَنَّا بِاللَّهِ And among the people, there are some of them who say, we believe in Allah. فَإِذَا أُوذِيَ فِي اللَّهِ جَعَلَ فِتْنَةَ النَّاسِ كَعَذَابِ اللَّهِ And when they are hurt in Allah's cause, they think the persecution of men as it were Allah's chastisement. وَلَئِنْ جَاءَ نَصْرٌ مِّن رَبِّكَ And if help comes from your Lord, لَيَقُولُنَّ Inna kunna ma'akum. They will surely and certainly say, verily we were with you. أَوَلَيْسَ اللَّهُ بِأَعْلَمَ بِمَا فِي صُدُورِ الْعَالَمِينَ. What? Is not Allah the best knower of what is in the breasts of mankind? So, this verse is implicitly saying that the expression of faith by some people is only oral, and it is not said by heart. وَمِنَ النَّاسِ مَنْ يَقُولْ أَمَنَّا. They only say that we believe in Allah. But the true faith will often be made manifest at the time of afflictions. فَإِذَا أُوذِيَ فِي اللَّهِ جَعَلَ فِتْنَةَ النَّاسِ كَعَذَابِ اللَّهِ. When they are hurt in Allah's cause, they think the persecution of man as if it were Allah's chastisement. Imam Ali alayhi salam, in this regard, has said, the reality and essence of man will be known in the change of circumstances. So, وَمِنَ النَّاسِ مَنْ يَقُولُ آمَنَّا. There are some people, among the people, are those who say, آمَنَّا. The Arabic word amanna, we believe, is used in the verse in plural form, while the next phrase is in singular. Because it may be for the reason that this group of hypocrites want to be counted among the group of believers, so they say amanna, and they mean that they have believed like other people. So you see, these hypocrites are really careful, and they are actually doing really tricky stuff in the society of Muslims, and that's why the Muslims need to be aware. So, as we were saying regarding this 10th verse of Surah Ankabut, these hypocrites are really careful in their manners in the society because they want to actually be considered with the other people of the society. So they say, Amanna. But, فَإِذَا أُوذِيَ فِي اللَّهِ, when they are hurt in Allah's cause, this means that they are hurt in the way of Allah. This means they are sometimes hurt in the way of Allah and faith by their enemies. So it is interesting that when speaking about the punishment of Allah, the Quranic word adab is used. But when it speaks about people's hurts, it uses fitna and trial. جَعَلَ فِتْنَةَ النَّاسِ كَعَذَابِ اللَّهِ. And this indicates that people's hurts are not in fact punishments, but they are trials in order to be completed by men in order to complete themselves. In this way, it teaches them that they might not compare those two with each other. And by the pretext that the opponents hurt and torture them, they leave out their faith, because this is a part of total program of trial in this world. So, before we move on, there arises a question here, that which victory had Allah bestowed on the Muslims in Mecca that hypocrites demanded to be part of it, that hypocrites demanded a share in it? The answer of it is that this sentence is a conditional sentence, and we know that a conditional sentence is not an evidence for the existence of the real condition happening actually, but its concept is that if there will be some victories for Muslims in future, these feeble faith hypocrites will demand share in it. Moreover, the Muslims gained some victories against enemies in Mecca, though they were not martial, and they were some victories in the fields of propagation or penetration in public thoughts, and the development of Islam amongst the different levels of people, but yet they demanded share in it. And the application of the word hurt, فَإِذَا أُوذِيَ فِي اللَّهِ, actually fits the environment of Mecca, else in the environment of Medina, such a thing rarely actually happened. But, however, this point was also made clear that the term hypocrites is not only used for those who have never faith inwardly and do not express faith, but those feeble faith people who, under the pressure of this and that individuals, soon change their belief and are counted among hypocrites. And the holy verse under discussion apparently speaks of this kind of hypocrite and announces that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is aware of their intentions. أَوَلَيْسَ اللَّهُ بِأَعْلَمَ بِمَا فِي صُدُورِ الْعَالَمِينَ. Is Allah not the best knower of what is in the breasts of mankind? Thank you for staying with us in this episode as well. Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
The birthday of Muhammad, peace be upon him and his progeny, marks the greatest celebration in history, 2016. Imam Khamenei. The resistance at the beginning of Bi'tha resulted in 3 years of unbelievable resistance in Shi'b Abi Talib. They lived in the sizzling sun in a valley near Mecca for 3 years. There were no plants and no water. And this is no joke. The Prophet ﷺ, Abi Talib, Khadija, and all Muslims and their families lived in this valley in the holes of the mountains. They had blocked all the ways so that they had no access to foodstuff. Sometimes when it was time for Hajj, in which, according to the rules of the ignorance era, no one was allowed to start a war, they were allowed to enter the town. But Abu Jahl, Abu Lahab, and other chiefs of Mecca had told their servants and children to pay twice the price and buy whatever the early Muslims needed to buy. They had been told to prevent Muslims from buying their requirements at a shop. It is no joke living in such difficult conditions for 3 years. It is such resistance and the heart that relies on Allah that gives rise to such solidity and makes people be patient. Children cried through the night out of hunger. The sound of their crying could be heard in Mecca, and some of the kind-hearted disbelievers of Quraysh felt sympathetic towards them. But no one dared to help them due to their fear of the powerful. That was while the faith of the early Muslims, whose children wasted away before their eyes, there were many people who died there, many were plagued with diseases, and many suffered from starvation, was not shaken. The commander of the faithful told his dear son, Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiya, the mountains may be shaken, they may be removed, but your faith must not be shaken. That was the same piece of advice that the Holy Prophet gave in his testament. That is the way the Islamic Ummah must rise up. That is what the Bi'tha of the Islamic Ummah means. That is the lesson that the Prophet ﷺ taught us. That is what Bi'tha teaches us. The most important element of unity is the existence of Muhammad, peace be upon him. We say that the holy existence of the great Prophet and Messenger of Islam, sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam, is the most important point in creating unity. We have said before that the world of Islam can meet at this point. This is a point where the emotions of all Muslims are connected to one another. This is the center of love and affection in the world of Islam. Of course, you can witness that in the present time, some authors who are financially supported by the Zionists pay attention to this center and insult it. They do this so that the importance of insulting the Islamic Ummah and humiliating the world of Islam diminishes. This is the main point.
Gave me hope, oh Allah, I want to thank you. I
global mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome to all our listeners from around the world. You are tuned in to Iran Radio. I'm here in the studio of Iran Radio in Tehran, announcing our program schedule for the next hour. Hope you will accompany us into the early hours of this morning. We start tonight's lineup with Minbar. You can listen to speeches on many different subjects by very well-known Islamic scholars and orators. They will be followed by our radio productions feature. After that, we have Spring of Truth, which delves into a selection of the statements and speeches by the founding father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, may Allah bless his soul. And we round up this hour's programs with Black and White, a program which informs you about the latest developments in Latin America. Stay with us for the next hour.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
The audience.